I want to welcome everyone on this sunny Sunday. the first of these this year's afternoon, Sunday afternoon reflections on Dhamma, or the way things are. And so to make it clear where I'm coming from, there's no attempt to tell you how things are. What I say is a reflective thinking rather than doctrinal positioning. And just to make the difference known that the Buddhist style is we're trying to open the mind up. We're not trying to condition the mind. We're not trying to convert or put anything onto you or intimidate or try to argue a point, convince you of anything I might be saying, but to stimulate the mind towards questioning, pondering, reflecting ability, contemplating. And even though this is quite ordinary for us, and so much of our social conditioning is to take positions and to think, have fixed positions on almost everything. Not to contemplate the meaning of existence or the purpose of life or what life is about or what love is or what is death and all this, but to have various views and opinions about it. And I know from my own social conditioning that one was expected to have opinions. And if you didn't have opinions, then of course that means you were stupid. So even sometimes you had opinions you didn't necessarily agree with, you still felt, unless you had an opinion on something, somebody might think that you really didn't know anything about anything. So I managed to form opinions, sometimes half-hearted views and that, sometimes very strong views, very emotionally charged opinions that one would could get very aggressive about. But in the spirit of the Dhamma, then we're beginning to look at that need to defend ourselves, need to prove ourselves in some way. Feeling that somehow we've got to become something, we've got to get something we don't have. We generally feel the way we are, we're not good enough, there's something wrong with us, and therefore we've got to do something to make ourselves better, but oftentimes feeling that we wouldn't succeed anyway. So a lot of modern life seems to be merely an attempt to just distract the mind. Modern materialist countries like this provide us with a wide range of distractions, or just keeping the mind occupied. The news, the gossip, the telly, all the different things available to us, push-button society in which the mind easily can absorb into things that we don't have to reflect on them. They merely just seem to absorb our attention. And this title for this Sunday is "Life is Love," and so this isn't meant to be a kind of inspiring talk. But contemplating just these very words, life and love, and what we really mean by them, or what maybe our own definitions of these words maybe are too narrow. I'm just questioning. And it's one thing in meditation, you're beginning to break down the conditioning of the mind, which does think in terms of life and death, as if they were death cancelled out life. There's life, which is conscious experience within a human, within a body, and then there's death, which is the absence of consciousness, or the whole process, mental physical process stops and decays, and that's death, which means that implies a kind of a total end of something that was once living and is now dead. So that's a kind of dualistic thinking. We think of life and death as opposition, one opposing the other. And so life is identified with the conscious experience of our own bodies, the fact that we're alive now, we're conscious, we can feel, we can see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, remember, imagine, use our minds for various tasks, we can move about. And so life is identified with the body and consciousness through the senses. And then we perceive death as when all this process stops, the body stops, the consciousness ceases, and the body decays, and that's death. But yet in religious terminology, sometimes we talk about eternal life, or deathlessness, or immortality. And Buddhism sometimes is identified with a kind of atheism, meaning a kind of denial of anything like eternal life or an immortal or immortality, or these kind of words oftentimes associated with other religious approaches. But it is very clear that the Buddha was pointing to the realization of the deathless. So it's a realization, it's a recognition, a direct knowing of immortality. And the word immortality, of course, is another word that it means deathless, absence of death, isn't it? Immortal. Mortality is death. And im is a negation of death. And yet immortality in the English language oftentimes means that, like, is a kind of romantic view of immortal, like a soul or a separate thing that lives in a conscious separate form forever. And I know that from my own religious background before becoming a Buddhist, there was definitely a feeling that an encouragement to think in terms of an immortal soul, that a deathless soul that was unique, that would go on and live forever, for eternity. And so this, of course, as I grew up and started questioning all these concepts, that didn't make sense to me. And personally, it didn't appeal to me. I never felt that as a person, as a separate being, that there's anything in its separateness that was worth carrying on forever. Any thought I had, the body itself, there didn't seem to be anything when I investigated that you would want to last forever in terms of the conditioning of the body or the mind. Would I want to be Ajahn Sumedho forever? Or would I want to be male masculine forever. Would I want? What would you want to live forever? If you know, in terms of what of your personality or the sense of yourself as a separate being. And I recently attended a funeral in California. Master Xun Hua, a Chinese Mahayana monk, died last June. And I knew him very well. He visited here in England, I think, about 5 years ago. Whenever I would go to California, I'd usually visit him and stay a few days in his monastery. He was a teacher that would emphasize the fact of coming out of nothing and returning to nothing. And so I went to see him before he died in the hospital, where he was in an intensive care unit, and he was in a coma. And so you could see he was still breathing, and they had all this technology, all these machines and tubes going into him and kind of pumping him with air and putting things into him and draining things out of him. And he was, you know, alive in the sense that in our terms, in the way we usually think of life, he was still breathing, but he wasn't, he was in a coma, so you couldn't say he was conscious in the way that we usually mean conscious. But the perception of that he was still alive was there. And so I asked some of the monks, I said, what do you expect him to die? What are you going to do when he dies? And nobody wanted to talk about it. They said, we're going to try to keep him alive. So you torture the poor thing with running tubes into him and kind of forcing this kind of this life, what we think is life, into him by pumping him full of things, just to have the feeling that he's living. Our teacher is living. And then about a week later, as I was in Seattle, the news came that he died, which didn't surprise me. And so then I phoned a monk I knew, his chief disciple, and of course the idea of Master Hua being dead was something that they knew inevitably was going to happen. But the mind didn't want to think about it, wanted to think in terms of he's alive rather than he's dead. But the teaching impressed me that Master Hua was emphasizing coming out of nothing and returning to nothing. And so even the word nothing is a word sometimes we don't appreciate, because in our dualistic thought patterns we conceive of nothingness as a kind of total blank, a vacuum, a void, with nothing in it and no potential for anything, just like a sterile vacuum. And we say, coming out of nothing, returning to nothing. We don't appreciate the kind of miraculous quality that is pointing to, the arising, the ceasing from nothing to something and back to nothing. Because the somethings of life we give our allegiance to. We like some things. We want things. We want conditions. We want people. We want to have relationships. We want to have respect. Or even just keeping the body alive. It's something. At least it's something we can understand and relate to. But nothing, sounds very depressing, or like it's a nihilist annihilationist, a nihilistic kind of perception. And yet in mystical experience, if you read Christian mystics or Sufis or in the Buddhist terms, the experience of God is nothing, or the experience of ultimate truth is no thing. And this point sometimes is completely overlooked, misunderstood, and in popular religious teachings never even mentioned. Because usually we give eternalist views, like when we die we go to heaven and live forever happy, and if we've been good then we'll live, and then we'll go and we'll live in a beautiful place with God and be happy and smile forever. And we're thinking in terms of just the pleasantness that we know about in this form, happiness, beautiful things to see and beautiful sounds and all that, all the best on the conditioned realm. We hope we'll to live in a place where there's no pain, no suffering, only beauty and pleasure forever. It's a kind of childlike view of what would be nice, having ice cream every day. So but the mystical vision, or when you get into going deeply into the way things are, getting beyond just the banal perceptions of social conditioning, the realizations aren't just trying to make everything pretty and nice and live in a realm of happiness, but the experience is experience of nothing, emptiness, they say, and oftentimes use the word emptiness, or selflessness, non-self. In Theravada, they emphasize anatta, non-self. Or the realization is nothingness, selflessness, emptiness, desirelessness, unconditioned, unborn, uncreated. And these words convey a realization, because this is to be realized. It's something that you can know. A realization isn't a belief in some abstract idea, but it is something you can know in a very profound way. Not know about in terms of having the perceptions of deathlessness or immortality. But it is real, it's reality, it's realization. So the religious path then is difficult for most people, because our conditioned mind tends to see no significance. We don't, unless we have a lot of kind of intuitive awareness and sensitivity already, we tend to settle down to a more vulgar expression of life, of just materialism, just trying to make life comfortable and pleasant and secure. But in spite of all that, and here in Britain, I think we've been fairly successful in making life pleasant and secure and you know, enough of the good things. And even at its best, even if, you know, even materialism at its best, leaves one completely dissatisfied. It's not satisfactory to us. Because there's a part of us that isn't being nourished in that. It's starving, you know, even though you might be well nourished on the level of organic food and physical comforts and good medical care and all the rest, somehow that isn't enough for us. That is not satisfying to us. That can merely kind of, that's all right, and there's nothing to, you know, it shouldn't be despised, but in itself, there's a longing for the deathless, for the ultimate truth. And love, then, is, in its pure expression, is love of what is ultimately true. Not just love of things that are temporary and just emotionally, that we need them emotionally and hold on to things that we feel we love. Because everything that we love will be separated from. Eventually, in some way, we're going to have to separate. Just like Master Xuanhua died. I mean, we loved Master Xuanhua, but then he died. And so when I looked at him, they had his corpse, his body on, so in a coffin that we could see the head. And we've given a chance to kind of contemplate, meditate on his face, the face of his dead teacher. And actually, in his coffin, after in the hospital, with all the tubes going in through him, he looked pretty horrid when he was alive. And the last memory of him as living was kind of bloated face and tubes going in everywhere. And he looked pretty dreadful, you know, visually. But when he actually died, and they put him in that in the coffin, in a refrigerated coffin, and he looked quite beautiful. His face looked very, very kind of radiant in a way. And so, and I kept thinking, I come out of nothing and return to nothing. And while contemplating this, of course, it actually my visual consciousness was focused on his dead face. That kind of meeting in conscious experience seemed to mean a lot. And the fact that one felt the reality of his teaching. One, I could see if I started thinking, "Oh, Master Hua's dead," and get caught up in my conditioning, my mental conditioning, then I would feel grief. I'd feel this sense of loss. I mean, he's dead now. I'll never see him again. And what are we going to do without him? And all the thoughts, the emotional thoughts that come from, say, the conditioning of the mind, and the sense of loss of a person, loss of someone you respect and love, where you'd have this emotional feeling of grief. So grief then is just that. It's that feeling of loss. We experience grief a lot, even before somebody we love dies or leaves us, don't we? We're just in everyday life, there's a certain amount of grief to it, losing something, a sense of loss or separation. When you're having a good time with somebody and you have to leave them, that sense of having to separate, that's a experience of grief, isn't it? It's a sense of loss. Because of the conditioning of the mind is very much like that. It will... when we're caught into the conditioning of the mind, the emotional habits, the language, the perceptions, and so forth, then the separation from the love, that feeling is grief. But then when you let go of grief, not suppress it, but when looking upon Master Hua's body, his corpse, then I change my direction from thinking, getting caught up in thinking about him as dead, but remembering the teaching, coming out of nothing, returning to nothing. And suddenly this marvelous peace and even joyfulness came, rather than grief. Because it became very real to me that he was, that what had died was merely a conditioned thing. I mean, one created him into being something, a great Chinese monk, a master, an enlightened being, whatever. You could project onto him all kinds of perceptions. And he was 77 years old. He's Chinese. He couldn't speak English very well, though when he did speak English, it sounded a bit comical. But he had this kind of mystery to him. He never knew what he was, you know, what was in his mind. What does he think of me? Is he reading my mind? I remember one time I was invited to their temple in Los Angeles, and so I was asked to give a talk one night, instruction on Buddhist meditation to the nuns, the bhikkhunis, in this temple in Los Angeles. And so I was sitting up in front on a kind of, it was, their temple in Los Angeles was an old Baptist church. I was sitting in kind of where the pulpit was, and giving this talk. And Master Hua kept kind of walking around, looking at me. And he kept kind of walking around the room, and he'd stand off there, and he'd look at me. And then he'd walk to the back, and he'd look at me. And he'd walk over there, and he'd look at me. And he'd walk right up next to me and look at me while I was talking. I was wondering what he was doing. He was, you know, he was sizing me up just to see how, you know, how, what I would do. Because I was talking about mindfulness, about meditation. I was giving instruction. Well, he seemed to have, he tended after that to say very complimentary things about me, which I of course appreciate. But I felt a great affinity with him personally, these kind of ways of feeling about certain people that you kind of almost immediately take to, and you don't know why. I mean, why you take to that one and not another one. Anyway, that's unexplainable. But this emphasis on nothing and emptiness, to many people, it terrifies them. And when we talk about love, then people feel inspired. Because love, to most people, is a word that conveys emotional experience, a way of a happiness, a way of looking at life that gives a quality and a beauty to our experience that we don't feel when there's no love in it. If our life is merely a critical life, if we only see things in ways of what's wrong, what I don't like, what's wrong with me, what's wrong with you, what's wrong with Britain, what's wrong with the EU, what's wrong with Bosnia, and everything else. I mean, we just get depressed, isn't it? Because that's not that isn't developing a loving relationship, is it? It's dwelling on things that are wrong. And things that are wrong, of course, they're not denying that they're, we're not saying everything's right. But this sense of being wrong, if we dwell on it, if we fill our minds with what's wrong, then the result of that is a feeling of we hate ourselves because we dwell on what's wrong, what we think is wrong with ourselves. We dwell on what's wrong with somebody else. We dwell on what's wrong with Britain, with Europe, with America, with whatever. And that, and when you just think, get obsessed with what's wrong, then you feel depression and despair. What else could you feel? Because you're deliberately filling your mind with negative views. And negative views, if that's what you obsess your mind with, then the result is despair and depression. Because it's a natural feeling to feel despair. When we fall in love, using just the romantic images of falling in love, then we don't, in the sense of love, then we're not dwelling on what's wrong with anything. We tend to not upset. I mean, it doesn't mean love blinds us to what's wrong, but it's no longer the thing that we're very interested in. We're more interested in the relationship itself and the feeling of that love always has this sense of union and oneness, and it isn't discriminative. It's not trying to make a big thing or make a problem about even what's wrong with somebody or something. So love, in terms of experience, is greatly desired, but also it's an experience that we can also fear, because it does mean to love one has to be open to life. You have to put yourself in a kind of vulnerable state, where the critical faculty gives you the sense that you're protecting yourself. I'm no fool. The cynic, you know. I'm nobody's fool. I don't fall for that slushy stuff. You know, I'm going to see, you know, nobody's going to hurt me. So we can feel very much obsessed with the intellectual, critical side as a kind of defense and protection, where love, and oftentimes we get hurt, especially when we fall in love. We're very vulnerable and we're easily hurt. So then we, after a few experiences of being bruised, hurt, mangled, abused from being open and vulnerable, then we tend to seek protection, develop the hide of a rhinoceros. And there is that verse in Dhammapada, go alone like rhinoceros. And I know monks that quote that all the time, because they're so afraid of love. They say, the Buddha said to be like a rhinoceros. That's their excuse. The Buddha said it, so that's what I'm going to do. And it's just, of course, it's out of context. And all metaphors, you know, are, need to be, you know, realized within their context. They're not absolutes. All metaphors fall apart eventually. So, I mean, it isn't to get reborn as a rhinoceros either. It'd be something. The Buddha said we should all practice so we can be reborn as rhinoceroses. An inspiring religion, isn't it? The thing that is frightening of being open and vulnerable as a person is that we do get hurt that way. If you are an open, like innocents, isn't it? Children are very open because they're innocent. But they're also easily hurt. You can corrupt, you can harm children very easily. Because they haven't lived long enough to develop the hide of a rhinoceros. They're not cynical yet. They're not defensive. And so they can be, one can easily abuse or harm them. Because they are open. And that's one of the images we have of the present day, where we hear so much about child abuse, isn't it? Where parents have sexually abused their own children, is a kind of horrific image, shocking to most of us, because the ideal is that parents are to protect the children. I mean, that's what I was always brought up to think. They should be protecting you while you're in that innocent phase, so you aren't being exposed to harmful things that can destroy you, shatter your life at such an innocent age. Or we read about the war in Bosnia and just the all the orphans, the mangled, children that have lost arms and legs and orphaned in that, just through this horrendous war that's been going on. We can feel such sadness. Just those images are incredibly sad, pathetic to the mind. Because in it, sometimes, especially around the loss of innocence, the abuse, the taking advantage, the destruction of the innocent to us, is something that one feels a great aversion to, a great indignation arises in the mind. So this realm that we live in, this realm of personality, of some being somebody, something, we are that something, that somebody, the goodness, the good fortune, the wealth, the security, the family security, the health, the social security, the whole lot, we realize, is something that can be taken away from us. That there's no security in this realm as a person, in the conditioned realm. I mean, if you have all the money in the world or whatever, it's still, you can lose it. You can be the richest person in the world, but you can also lose it, and you know it. You can have a secure family with good parents and a beautiful place to live, and suddenly lose it, like people in Yugoslavia. Suddenly 5 minutes to leave their houses. And they have to leave within 5 minutes. Just suddenly somebody stands at the door and says, leave, and you leave. And then you're separated from your parents or your husband or wife, and you don't know what's happened to anything. And so you have to just, you're put in this state of not knowing and fear and terror. And so these are things to consider. This could happen to us. Hope it won't, but it certainly recognize that possibility before I die of having everything, everyone I know, everything that I like, and that suddenly taken away from me. And then death, of course, the death of the body is that experience. You leave everything, separate from everything. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. So that's why the Buddha was saying, do not attach, do not seek refuge or values in the conditioned realm. It's not a pessimistic teaching, it's pointing to the reality that this realm is like this. the conditioned realm, the body, the emotional things, the objects of our senses and so forth are relative and can easily be taken away from us. That's just the way it is. There's nothing wrong with that. I'm not trying to even complain about it. It's just the way it is. And so in meditation, reflective meditation, we keep reminding ourselves, this is the way it is. But the aim isn't to just think the way it is in a kind of passive fatalism. You say, well, that's the way it is. Life is like that. It's not that. But it's moving to realize the deathless is the aim of the Buddha Dhamma. Or in terms of Christianity, union with God, or these are the words or the metaphors or the symbols for that experience of realization, returning to the source, coming out of nothing, returning to nothing. And that nothing then, say, is something that opens the mind rather than it implies a denial or a kind of nihilism. No thing, no thingness. Because I felt when contemplating Master Hua's corpse was that he wasn't really dead. His body was dead. But what one really respected and loved about Master Hua was deathlessness. Wasn't the body. Wasn't his personality. Wasn't his kind of charisma. Wasn't any of these conditioned things that were temporary and relative to situations. But getting beyond just the attachment to those qualities or those conditions was the love of the truth or the love of the ultimate reality or the whatever you would say, the love of God or the love of the Dhamma. So there was so that love then taken away as we transcend projecting, attaching, creating attachments to things that we love, people that we love. When we stop that, when we let go of that, then we begin to realize love or life itself or deathlessness. So even concepts like eternal life, which I used to scoff at and say, Buddhists, we don't believe in eternal life. When you contemplate and get beyond just the ordinary interpretations of those words or the emotional associations that you have with them, you begin to recognize a reality beyond the words being used. You realize the truth that not trying to interpret from the meaning of the word. The words themselves are there as a kind of reminder, but not to be attached to, not to be held to in the worldly way that we usually think. Like nothingness, emptiness, no self, desirelessness, when we think in our worldly way, that sounds like annihilationism. It sounds like a bleak nothing, a boring kind of total vacuum. Eternal life, then, is sounds positive. But eternal life is always based on positive images, on happiness, and happy relationships and beautiful things in heaven. Are there any mosquitoes or wasps? Here at Amaravati, we have a lot of wasps. I was at the Leicester Summer School, just got back yesterday, a beautiful place in the botanical gardens, sitting there in paradise with wasps. We'd eat out on the lawn, and then they'd go for your watermelon. And they'd drown themselves in your orange juice. You don't even have to rescue the blasted things. And then just as I was coming back, one stung me right here. Heaven, they wouldn't have wasps. Unless you are a wasp, like I'm. A wasp is an Americanism for the privileged elite of the Americans. It means white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And I'm sure in an American wasp heaven, that's all that's there. Well, how boring that would be. I mean, be stuck with a bunch of wasps forever. Now, this is reflecting on say love, then, and to say we use things like unconditioned love, or in Christianity, Christian love, or what is it? Even though we have, you know, and we can see romantic love, or love can of course mean almost anything now. It's used in all pop music, and so it. It's the most kind of ordinary word that's yet very powerful. I mean, it's a very powerful word, no matter how much it's abused or how vulgar we might be with the word, you know, use it for just anything. But it is a word that we need to, that we can contemplate. And so when I contemplate that word, just the L-O-V-E, English word, and taking it to an experience, that from my own experience, not just hearing about somebody else, but from my own experience as a Buddhist monk, say, is there love absent from the life of a Buddhist monk? And so forth. Do we lack that love as an experience? And how I tend to see this word now is seeing that this life itself is love, because it's a sacrifice of the self and the selfishness, sacrifice, it's willing to relinquish the world, the conditions, willing to let go, and a sincere endeavor to realize this letting go, this non-attachment, not out of fear of the conditioned realm, but out of love for the truth, out of a real aspiration for that realization of the truth. And that's something that we all can relate to, all humanity. Sometimes you wonder whether Ratko Madlik, that he gets pretty bad press, but especially have a name like Ratko, it doesn't go very well in a country like this. But Ratko Mladic. It sounds like something from Batman. So then life itself, is it just being conscious, or is life, can we really contemplate life as deathlessness rather than as just consciousness within a separate form? I don't know, really. I'm just opening the question up. You know, these are words. They're man-made words. These words are we can contemplate them, how to use them. And if life is just if death and life are opposed to each other, maybe that's just the way we think, the kind of way we're conditioned to perceive. He's alive, he's dead, and that's it. But in terms of the religious aspiration and the mystical realization of deathlessness, then life takes on a different sense. The unconditioned. Because is the unconditioned dead? Is the nothingness that Master Hua comes from and goes back to, is that dead? Is that deadness, or is that life? And the condition that was born, grew up, grew old and died, that was consciousness, form and consciousness, that dies because it was born. So is the unconditioned, or the ultimate truth, is it dead? Is it deadness? Or is death merely the simple ending of what was born? And then as we contemplate this through mindfulness and wisdom, we begin to realize deathlessness is reality. Not the facts of life, where you're born and then you die and that's it. That's the kind of cynical hard line. But when you really pay attention and witness to your conscious experience, that's not how it seems at all. That's not what I'm picking up through when I'm really mindful. I can easily fall back into the old patterns of thinking and go along with the worldly attitudes because I'm used to that. That's how my mind works on the thinking level. But in terms of the insight and realization, that's not what I'm getting. So I want to end the formal part of this talk at this point, leave you contemplating that, and then have a break, 10-15 minute break, and we can have some tea, and then for those who want to pursue this subject any further, you're welcome to come back and we will discuss it.